Welcome to Inside Impella Transport Talks, your co-pilot for training. I'm Shane Turner, and I'm so glad you're here. As members of Abiomed's Critical Care Transport Team, we know that every transport is a lifeline and every moment counts in our mission to recover hearts and save lives. Today, we're talking about the transformative impact of point-of-care ultrasound, also known as POCUS, in transport medicine. Joining us is Isaac Bennett, a flight paramedic with over 14 years of experience, who will share how POCUS is revolutionizing care for Impella-supported patients on the move. You'll learn about how this tool helps navigate complex clinical signs, enhance Impella management, and ultimately save more lives. Let's talk.
I am a flight paramedic with Hospital Wing. I've been involved in EMS for, 14 years now. Gosh, the time kind of slips away a little bit. And I've been flying with the wing for around 7 years now. My base is based out of Memphis. Most of our bases are within the local area of Western Tennessee and Arkansas and Mississippi.
Well, thanks for joining us, Isaac. So today I'd like to do, let's dig into some topics we haven't covered yet. And let's talk about point-of-care ultrasound. So point-of-care ultrasound has been a passion of mine for a while. So in my previous life as a flight clinician, I was blessed to work at a pretty progressive program, and we implemented point-of-care ultrasound early on into the transport. And obviously, multiple applications. But since this is the Inside Impella Transport Talks, let's see how this could benefit our Impella-supported patients. So when you think about how Abiomed advocates for use of ultrasound in Impella-supported patients, it's mainly referencing the in-hospital phase of that care. So most commonly, we'll use bedside sonography when we are doing, obviously, a full-blown echocardiogram. But even in the point-of-care world, it's more of a, hey, let's get a quick idea of where that Impella is position-wise. So for accurate positioning, we strive for approximately 3.5 centimeters from the aortic valve annulus to the tip of the Impella. Okay, that's hyper-technical information that doesn't mean much to folks that don't work in that world every day. So when you talk about in transport, if we have a malposition, even if your program is incredibly advanced with point-of-care ultrasound and your clinicians are incredibly skilled, we don't really scratch the surface when we compare to these cardiac sonographers who have done thousands upon thousands upon thousands of echocardiograms. So what would you think would be the biggest utility of point-of-care ultrasound in regards to Impella-supported patient care?
So when I think about point-of-care ultrasound in the field or pre-hospital, you hit the nail on the head when you mentioned that we are not truly sonographers. So we have a certain level of competence with the tool that does not make us experts with the tool. But the same thing goes for looking at 12-lead, looking at cardiology across the board. We're utilizing a tool and we're pretty good at it, but that doesn't make us cardiologists. That doesn't mean that we can interpret everything that that 12-lead can offer us. So when I think about how we can use point-of-care ultrasound in an Impella patient, I kind of think about it in a couple of ways. So first and foremost is going to be tracking down alarms and seeing what I can do to mitigate those alarms. So I can use point-of-care ultrasound to kind of give me an idea of whether or not this patient is going to, I like to think of it as tolerate volume. Rather than trying to gauge a volume status, I like to think of whether or not they can tolerate more volume kind of in the overall picture. So that can help me track down some of the possible alarms that we get with our Impella patients. Another key point that you mentioned is actually looking at the location of where that Impella is sitting in the heart. And you're right, that is kind of some technical information as far as being able to measure where we're at in relation to the annulus and the aortic valves. But if we can get an idea of where that Impella is sitting in relation to that left ventricle before we leave the bedside, then we will have a better idea of what has changed en route, if anything does change. So it kind of helps, again, troubleshoot a little bit those possible alarms. It's just like physically documenting and measuring the centimeter depth on the lines. So if we look at our point of insertion, we always want to document where that last tick mark is. Same thing for the ET tube. That way, if something does change, I know where my point of reference was, and it kind of can give me a game plan of where I want to go.
I like the way you included the, you know, those other frame of references for position, because I think that's where ultrasound finds itself lending the biggest utility in transport, is it's not the sole source of information, but it's secondary confirmation, or it helps us narrow differentials, or it's supplemental to what we already suspected based on physical findings and things like that. So just like you said, in this instance, I know what my centimeter markings are. They were documented that when the physician was happy with the position, it was implanted and secured at X number of centimeters. And we're going to check that when we get to bedside. But if you're skilled enough with the ultrasound, we recommend that you utilize the parasternal long axis view for placement. But as you and I both know, I mean, getting just that right fan and that right angle and, you know, navigating body habitus and finding that perfect view that gives you that beautiful, hey, outflow tract, aorta, aortic valve, LV, and now we're looking for the impella across there. I mean, it's like, I think I see this shiny spinny heart snake thing in here, and can I discern these 256 shades of gray? So, I mean, I get it. I hear you, but I want to play devil's advocate and say, I feel like there's probably a better utility besides just positioning. What do you say to that?
Absolutely. There are other things that we can do with it. And looking as far as positioning, that's just going to give us an idea of where things are at and which direction we're going to go. But you're 100% right. Cardiac views are not the easiest views in the world for us to get, especially when you think about the patients that we're dealing with. A lot of times with a cardiac view, in order to find what you're looking for, you have to actually manipulate where your patient is. So it's not just about probe manipulation. It's about patient positioning. And that's definitely a struggle for us in the pre-hospital world, is typically our patients are in a position that they're going to be in. So we can't necessarily manipulate where they're at. We have to work around them. So to your point, yes, if the view is not there to be had, there's not much we can do to optimize that view. And again, we're not experts. We're just trying to be competent with the tool. So yeah, there are other things that we can use that tool for, that sometimes those windows are a little bit easier for us. So being able to check volume responsiveness tolerance, again, is kind of what I like to think of with that. So we can typically get a pretty good shot of the IVC. We can get a shot of the lungs to make sure that we're not fluid overloading somebody. And we can make an attempt at some other cardiac views and see what utility they can offer us.
So Isaac, when we're doing these scans on the IVC, what is the best view? So in your opinion, what's the easiest way, or what tips or techniques do you have for folks to get a good, clear sight on this IVC and what it's doing?
So typically when I am trying to look at the IVC, again, because I'm not an expert, I'm just trying to be competent with the machine. I like to try to hit the same landmarks every time and then adjust fire as I need to. So when I'm looking for the IVC, first of all, I'm typically doing a short axis view so I can get that the two great vessels in view as well as the spine sign. So then I've got my three landmarks. Once I have my three landmarks, then I can make that determination pretty easily, which one is pulsatile, which one's not. And again, you have to make sure that your indicators are in the right spot and that you're lined up on the appropriate side of the patient. But once I have my three landmarks in sight, it's pretty easy to turn on a long axis view and get on that IVC. And typically that's going to be the probe indicator towards the patient's head. And then we just sort of rock a little bit and shoot just a little bit underneath that sternum to get that view of the heart. And we can follow that IVC straight up to where it hits the atria. And normally the landmark I'm looking for is, first of all, I want to find that once I turned on that long axis, I want to follow that vessel up and make sure that I can see where it's actually dumping into the heart and make sure that I'm not sitting on the aorta. So the aorta should not actually dump into the atria. If it does, you've got other issues going on that I don't think Impella is going to fix. But if we can follow that IVC up, we can see where we hit the heart and we can actually clearly see that hepatic vein coming in. Great landmarks. You've got great points of reference for where you can actually start watching that IVC and make a determination on whether or not you think it's going to be plethoric or responsive.
I like your approach there. You know, bring it back, make it a more global assessment tool. So, you know, when we do these transport training classes, you know, we utilize the acronym PAPP, and we kind of use this as, this is your systematic approach for troubleshooting the Impella patient. So you have an Impella patient, you're transporting, you're absent of any active alarm conditions, but yet you've noticed your mean Impella flows have trended down. So that's when that PAPP really comes into play. So you pull out your badge buddy that we gave you at training, PAPP, the first P is preload. And when we talk about the Impella device being preload dependent, you know, that could be, that's kind of a global term in and of itself too, right? Like if it's preload, is it because we are intravascularly depleted? So literally I'm hypovolemic in my vessels, or am I having a preload problem because I have some degree of right ventricular dysfunction? Now, drilling down on that in the transport environment, does it really matter? Probably not. You can only steer your clinical decision-making so far. But if I'm trying to mitigate this issue, and let's say it was even to the extreme that I now have an active suction event, and I suspect it's because it's a preload problem, what would be the best study if I'm flying or transporting at a program that utilizes POCUS? What would be the biggest, I guess, dividends that I could get, or the most fruitful answers or evidence that I could yield from a POCUS study for that specific problem?
So in that case, when you're talking about preload, the easiest thing to do is probably to check the IVC. And that's, you know, you have two camps on the IVC about whether or not it really gives us a lot of utility in being able to make a judgment on the volume status of your patient. But it is normally a relatively easy scan to do. Assuming that the patient's body habitus allows for it, it is not super invasive. It's typically not a super complicated view. So it can give us a little bit of feedback, and it's relatively simple to put the probe on the chest, find that IVC, and get an idea of whether or not, I think of it in terms of being fat or flat. I like to keep everything relatively general where I can. So I, for the largest part, I don't try to pull out calipers unless I'm really getting off into the weeds. So what I want to know is there variability in that IBC? If there is variability and it is not, I believe plethoric is the term that people like to use. I call it fat. Fat or flat's easier for me to remember. So if I have a fat IBC, there's a relatively decent chance that they're not going to tolerate a lot more as far as volume goes. So then I have to start making other considerations and looking at the patient overall. Now, it's none of these things are just a single point that's going to give me everything that I need to know. I have to look at everything as far as how the patient presents to me as an overall picture. But the IVC is a pretty good place to start to make a determination on how they're handling the fluid that they have. If there's a lot of variation on that IVC, if they are capable of performing that sniff test and that IVC collapses by greater than 50%, we can probably move forward with fluid pretty quickly, and they can most likely tolerate a 250, 500 while I'm making other decisions.
That's interesting. And, you know, and I also understand that a single assessment like an IVC diameter measurement does not necessarily correlate that they're going to, you know, completely empty their ventricle during the cardiac cycle. But if we have evidence to suggest that they may be low intravascularly, we could probably safely assume that ventricular filling may be affected, right?
As long as that IVC looks like there's plenty of room to expand and it doesn't look like it's already plethoric and overloaded, then we can, I like to think of just kind of getting a baseline, getting a start on a treatment, so getting fluids going, and then that gives me the opportunity to circle back around and make those other assessment points so I can really kind of dial in where I want to take my patient. So I would typically start with the IBC just to get an idea of where we're at on kind of a backflow issue. So first of all, is there fluid moving forward? So if that IBC is distended, well, then I'm going to hold off on that fluid decision because it means either they're volume overloaded or the heart can't really tolerate any more fluid right now. So then I need to move up to another assessment point and see where we're at from that perspective.
So again, we're utilizing these ultrasound images not as standalone evidence or criteria to base decisions on, but in conjunction with other findings. And it's similar to how we speak to CVP values or mean arterial pressures. Like, you take in the whole clinical picture together. So if I have evidence that my IVC is collapsible, if I have evidence that my CVP is low and that my mean arterial pressure is low, collectively now I have more confidence that I probably am going to have an issue with ventricular filling. So that's low-hanging fruit. All right, cool. CVP was low, MAP was low, IVC squishy, boom, fluids, we're good. What if it wasn't? What if we're now at that decision tree? We're like, well, that's kind of what I suspected, but this now tells me otherwise. What would be the next thing you would look at? Because I'm still having this active suction event that I'm trying to figure out. Is it preload? Is it positioning? Like, what's going on here?
Okay. So the next leg up, the next part of the journey, as far as that assessment process goes, is if I've already checked below the heart, I'm probably going to move up to the chest. So I kind of like to take things in sort of like boxes. I like to move and reposition myself in a box. So I want to check that abdomen, check that IVC in that box, and then I'm going to move up to the chest box. I personally like to know what my lungs look like as far as how they're tolerating fluid, because it's easy. It's so quick and easy to pick out a beeline and kind of give me a determination on whether or not I've got any fluid backing up into the lungs, especially when I'm in a environment where I can't hear lung sounds. So it's so easy in the transport environment when we're flying to drop that probe on the chest. Within a couple of seconds, I can make a determination of whether or not those lungs appear to have any type of interstitial fluid. That is a quick box to check, and then I can move on to that heart, and I can actually start looking at ventricles, and I can look at how large and responsive. The left ventricle is typically where I want to look, but the left ventricle is going to have a device in the middle of it, right? So that can potentially interfere with the windows that I'm getting. So I'm probably going to make an attempt to kind of gauge that right ventricle and see what that right ventricle is doing for me. So if we're talking about that patient where we have a suction event, we have that suction alarm, and we're trying to make a determination on whether or not we have a position issue or a volume issue, that IVC is fat and it doesn't want to show me a lot of variation. Those lungs look like there's no interstitial fluid at this time. If we take a look at that right ventricle, and that right ventricle is distended, or I think the cutoff is around 60% the size of your left ventricle. So if that right ventricle is distended, then I'm probably going to start leaning towards some sort of infusion, like some sort of inotrope, to see if I can get a little bit more squeeze out of that rather than dropping more fluid on that heart.
I like it. And again, we're just steering these decisions based on more evidence as we find them. What about these situations where, like, is it appropriate to even do an LV study? Like, is it even important to look at what the left ventricle is doing? I mean, we know there's some level of dysfunction, moderate to severe, depending, because there's an Impella in there doing the work of the heart. So if you had this traditional path in your little POCUS repertoire that you always did this LV study because you were curious about the squeeze, right? You wanted to see, is it hyperdynamic or hypodynamic? Is that kind of a moot point once the Impella is in?
So to be honest, I don't know the answer of whether or not it's a moot point, but I'll tell you, as far as kind of staying on path with my protocol, I would do a long axis view. I would look at that left ventricle and I would get an idea of how that left ventricle is trying to respond. So to my knowledge, a weak and distended left ventricle is just an inability of that ventricle to squeeze. That shouldn't necessarily, as far as I know, be any type of inhibition of that left ventricle making an attempt to be hyperdynamic. So I know that there are kind of two different camps there. So you've got the left ventricle that cannot perform the function of squeezing. But I still want to get an idea of how hard it's trying, honestly. So a lot of my decision points is, how hard is your heart working, and what can I do to help that heart function? So yes, if there is something physically in that left ventricle taking up space, it is going to interfere with the squeeze, but that's also why it's there. So just to stay on path, I am definitely going to look at that left ventricle. And ideally, this is something that I would do at the bedside, again, to kind of get an idea of what my starting point is. So if I run into this scenario en route, I can see whether or not something has changed.
I get that. But you know, that also kind of bleeds into what's going on in the hospital when we're getting together as a care team to say, hey, what level of support does this patient need? You know, because they've had the full echocardiogram. We've done quantitative measurements and calculated ejection fractions versus this kind of qualitative view where you're like, well, it appears to be hypodynamic. So generically speaking, let's call it a reduced ejection fraction, sure. Right? Like we have much more data on the inside. And that's, you know, and that's part of that bundle of information that the cardiology team is going to use to say, well, what P level do we need to start at? And then obviously, you know, we work up and down based on multiple other factors. But that's why I kind of threw that out there, because I'm like, well, if the Impella, I'm sitting here thinking while we're talking, like if the Impella's in, do I really care what the LV's doing if all my other things look like it's right?
Sure. You know? Sure. I'll play devil's advocate also. So the flip side to that is if they're giving me this information, if they already have quantitative measures for the function and cardiac output and the flow of that left ventricle, if I can put my probe on it and say, okay, this is what you're telling me, this is a measured flow. Now I've got a point of reference, right? So now I can look at that LV and I can say, this is what I would think it is. And you're telling me this is what your measurement was. So again, if I have a drastic change, it kind of leads me down a different pathway. But yeah, I mean, to your point, yes, something is there taking up space. It is intrinsically going to interfere with the function of that ventricle.
In reality, they're going to say, thanks for playing silly flight medic. Now get out of here.
Typically, yeah.
All right, Isaac. Well, that's great information, man. I really appreciate that. I think that's super helpful, especially if, like I said, this reaches clinicians who fly at programs that have, you know, robust POCUS experience. You know, and obviously the caveat to all this is we're not trying to replace your medical control. We're not trying to replace your patient care guidelines. And even from an Abiomed standpoint, our firm recommendations on the utilization of ultrasound are very limited and usually exclusively for the in-hospital providers, the advanced providers, and looking at positioning. The whole idea here, though, is to kind of bring this into the world of transport, because POCUS is an ever-emerging and gaining popularity in transport for all sorts of utility, right? So specific with Impella, you know, the volume responsiveness, the preload problems, the suction, maybe on the positioning, right? But what would be your advice? So let's capitalize on your presence here and to our transport community. What would be your advice to clinicians who are wanting to get better at POCUS? So obviously we talked about how to grab that IVC scan, but what tips and techniques do you have to just get better at getting good diagnostic imaging?
So that obviously that depends on what your resources are. So there are two ways that you can, there are a lot of ways, how about this, a lot of different ways that you can get experience. And to a certain extent, your experience is what you make of it. So if you have a medical director who has experience with point of care ultrasound and they are responsive to answering your questions, that's kind of a caveat there. Get all the knowledge that you can from them. So do a little bit of your own research, and then take it to someone who would be an expert and ask them, why is this that way? What am I looking for? What are these different scenarios where this would be that thing? But really, it does at some point require that you be able to put your hands on a probe. So you can sit in front of the screen and you can study all the images and you can get a fantastic wealth of knowledge and just have all of that knowledge in your mind ready to go, but you still have to have an opportunity to express it. Really being able to put your hands on the probe and honestly play with it. That's how you get the experience. That's how you learn how to make the subtle manipulations. That's where you find the landmarks that work for you and click in your mind so that you can come back to that spot when you need to. So being able to put my hands on a probe and take it into our little crew room during some downtime, putting some gel on myself and pulling it out and seeing what can I find on me. What are the landmarks that I can identify every time and then move offline as I need to? So a perfect example is when we're talking about that IVC again, to come back to that, my point of reference is going to be the xiphoid process, every patient, every time. And I'm going to hit the landmarks where I expect to find what I'm looking for and then adjust as I need to. And that's because I found on myself that if I use that point of reference, I can find that landmark on me. Then when I bring it to a patient and I'm trying to do a patient assessment, I found that if I hit that landmark, it's a lot easier to adjust off of that one position every time. So really just having the opportunity to put your hands on the device and utilize it and explore with it. And then go back to your references and say, okay, so this was what I saw. This was how I found it. What does it actually mean to me? So when we talk about the different components of a cardiac exam, cardiac windows are not simple. And there are so many things that can change your ability to get those windows, your patient habitus, not just the patient habitus, but the positioning of the patient. There are other physiological things that can go into it. So depending on if they have a history of cardiomegaly, if they've got a history of CHF, all that can kind of shift the anatomy around slightly that can kind of skew that window that you're used to getting. It really just comes down to being able to put your hands on something, get an idea of the landmark you want to hit every time, and then knowing your points of reference to move off of that landmark to kind of find the spots that you need.
I love it, man. You know, this was fun, dude. This was fun because this was different than the normal thing. And, you know, it's Impella, you know, like we said, and bridging that gap between that and POCUS, you know, it is a stretch. You know, and by no means are we saying that this is a tool you have to use, especially if your program doesn't have it. But for those of you that utilize POCUS, it's another thing to think about. It's another angle of approach there, angle of attack, if you will. But this was really fun, Isaac. I really appreciate your time.
Man, yeah. Thank you, Shane. I appreciate you having me.
Thanks for listening to Inside Impella Transport Talks. We're here to support you in recovering hearts and saving lives. For more Impella Transport information, visit us at heartrecovery.com/transport. And if you like our podcast, please head to your favorite podcast platform to subscribe and give it a 5-star rating. This podcast is sponsored by Abiomed. The information, findings, and conclusions expressed are those reached independently by the authors.